Good morning. Let's go ahead and begin. This is a meeting of the Initiative Title Setting Review Board, a meeting pursuant to Article 40 of Title 1. Colorado Revised, you can't hear me? Ceci is the... Yeah, I feel like I'm hearing myself, but... There is a fan on this side that makes it a little hard there. Mr. Caldera, is it broadcasting in the back? And I'll try to speak up. This is a meeting of the Title Setting Board pursuant to Article 40 of Title 1, Colorado Revised Statutes. The date is April 7th, 2010. The time is 9:31 a.m. We're meeting in the Secretary of State's Blue Spruce Conference Room, 1700 Broadway, Denver, Colorado. My name is Bill Hobbs. I'm Deputy Secretary of State, and I'm conducting the meeting on behalf of Secretary of State Bernie Busher. The other members of the Title Board this morning are as follows. To my immediate left is Dan Carton, Deputy Director of the Office of Legislative Legal Services. He is the designee of the Director of the Office of Legislative Legal Services, Charlie Pike, for this morning's measures, the first two measures, and then this afternoon, for the two measures on our agenda, the director's designee will be Sharon Eubanks, also Deputy Director of the Office of Legislative Legal Services. To my immediate right is Dan Domenico, Solicitor General, here on behalf of Attorney General John Southers. To my far left is Maury Kanizer, Deputy Attorney General, who represents the Title Board. And to my far right is Ceci Gomez of the Secretary of State's Office. A few words about our procedures. For anyone who wishes to testify on any of our agenda items, there are sign-up sheets on the table by the door. When you testify, please come to the mic and identify who you are and who you represent. The meeting is recorded, and it's also broadcast over the Internet. Our procedures for new measures that come before the Title Board are as follows. First of all, the Title Board is not concerned with the merits of any issue, but only with the setting of objective and brief titles. In order to accomplish that, when we have a new measure, the first step is to make sure that the Title Board understands the measure. So I'll first provide an opportunity for the Title Board members to ask questions of the proponents to make sure that we understand what the measure does. The second step is to determine if the Title Board has jurisdiction to set a title, and that necessarily requires determining if the measure complies with the single subject requirement of the Constitution. And then third, if the Title Board does decide that it has jurisdiction to set a title, then the board will work on setting those titles using a staff-prepared draft, copies of which are on the table by the door. A decision is reached by two of the three members of the board. Normally, we move to board discussion after all testimony has been received. Anyone who's dissatisfied with the decision of the board may file a motion for rehearing within 7 days of today, in which case the motion for rehearing would be held on the next regularly scheduled meeting of the Title Board, which is April 21st. The Title Board meets on the first and third Wednesdays of each month. April 21st, is the last regularly scheduled meeting to consider new measures, for consideration on the ballot in November. So with that, I'm going to turn to the agenda for today. The first agenda item is 2009-2010, number 53, campaign finance. I would like to mention one other thing with respect to this measure. I did, because there is an assessment on income tax returns, I did ask the state's chief economist for the Colorado General Assembly for fiscal information. She was kind enough to provide an analysis of the fiscal impact. A copy of that, I believe, is on the table as well. So I'd like to thank Natalie Mullis for that, and also Janice Barron of the Fiscal Notes staff of Legislative Council for providing that information. I'd like to hear, for this agenda item, I'd first like to hear from the proponents. Is there a representative of the proponents that could come forward? Good morning, sir. If you would come to the microphone and introduce yourself for the record and who you represent.
I am Jim Hoffmeister. I'm chair of what's called Clean Campaigns Colorado. What else would you like to know?
As I indicated, I guess the first question would be to see if the title board members have any questions for you about the measure. The one question I think I would like to ask right off is this particular measure based on legislation or provisions in another state? Is there a model for this?
Yes, it is. Arizona and Maine were the two primary states examined. There was a model bill prepared by what's called Public Campaign, and we followed those suggestions. Some of our sections mirror them. Others we've deviated from because we didn't think they fit Colorado.
Okay, thank you. Are there questions for Mr. You said it was Hoffmeister, is that correct?
It's Jim Hoffmeister.
Okay, thank you. Are any questions for proponents?
When I have a chance, I have one question for you.
Okay, go ahead.
Well, I looked at Natalie Mullis's analysis, and incidentally, I respect Natalie Mullis very much. I've gotten some other information from her regarding the effect of tax reductions in Colorado over the last decade, but I think she made a mistake in her figures. If you look at
Let me make a suggestion.
Yes, sir.
When it comes up, assuming the board finds that it has jurisdiction to set a title and we start to work on a title, then I think then the fiscal information will be relevant. And it's only information, and if you disagree with it, then I'd certainly want to hear about that. I ask for it simply because the draft title, staff draft, has a blank in it for the fiscal impact, and so I wanted some information, but we're not bound by that, so we certainly want to hear if you disagree.
Thank you. Could I say anything else, or would it be appropriate to say anything else at this point?
About the measure generally?
Mm-hmm.
Sir, sure, go ahead.
Well, what's the driving force behind our efforts is the belief that money plays an inordinately important role in how we elect people to office today. This is not to indict people who are running for office and who win, but if you look at the data, and we've analyzed Colorado's data for 3 years, 4 years of elections, and over 90% of the time, those who have the most money contributed win. And the second aspect of that is that I've heard some of our legislators, including Andrew Romoff, say the minute they get elected, they're now worrying about getting reelected. So they spend an inordinate amount of time trying to think how they're going to raise money. It's our contention that the proposed amendment to our Constitution would remove that pressure and place it on talking constituents in the respective districts. So that's the driving force behind this effort. Thank you.
Thank you. Further questions of proponents? One other question that I have, I guess, is there's a number of provisions that deal about the situation if there's a runoff election. And I think for the covered positions here, Colorado law currently doesn't provide for runoff elections for statewide officers and legislative candidates, State Board of Education. I assumed that would have those provisions that apply to runoff elections would apply when and if future laws might provide for that.
Illustrate my ignorance. Yes, that's a good qualifier. Just a little bit more about us. None of us were legal experts. I'm a psychologist. Two were retired aircraft pilots. One worked for the state in an administrative position. So we were really following what we thought were reasonable guidelines in other states, and so that may be one that doesn't fit. You also might be interested to know we've learned a lot in the process and have enjoyed it.
Okay. Thank you.
Interesting.
So any other questions? If not, then the next step is that I'll turn to the question of whether the measure complies with the single subject requirement or if there's any other jurisdictional issues. For that, I'd like to find out if there's anybody who would like to testify that the measure, that the board does not have jurisdiction to set a title. Mr. Leventhal, were you planning to testify on that issue?
Only to add to what Jim Hoffman says.
Okay. Certainly not in opposition. So
I'm
just trying to find out if anybody would argue that the measure does not comply with the single subject requirement. And I don't see anyone stepping forward, and I don't have anyone else signed up. So I'll turn to board discussion of the single subject issue. Any discussion, Mr. Carden?
Mr. Chairman, it seems to me that the measure does cover a single subject, campaign finance, citizen-funded campaigns. So it appears to me that it meets the single subject requirement that the board has jurisdiction to go ahead and set a title.
I think I agree. There's no disagreement, perhaps at least offer a motion, Mr. Carden.
I move that measure number 53, campaign finance, meets the single subject requirements of the Constitution, and the board has jurisdiction to set a title, and that the board proceed with setting a title for the measure.
I'll second that. Any further discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed say no. That motion carries 3-0. Then let's turn to the titles, and we do have a staff draft, and I think we also have a suggested title from the proponents as well. Normally we would work off of the staff draft, but if there's reason to work from the proponents' draft, we could do that as well. Mr. Hoffmeister, would you like to explain why you prefer the proponents' draft title, or maybe I should ask you also just what is your reaction to the staff draft?
Well, it's very positive. I was surprised it was called a title. I was expecting something like Colorado Citizen Fund Campaigns as a title. But I have no problem with it. As a matter of fact, it illustrates that the staff has read our proposed legislation, because they added one sentence at the last, which I didn't think was that important, but the staff thought it was. And so I was pleasantly surprised. I think it's an excellent summary of our bill. It almost matches word for word in one sense of what we submitted as a summary statement. So I was quite pleased. I am quite pleased.
Thank you. Mr. Leventhal, did you want to comment on the titles?
Yes. I'm a little bit confused about the...
Why don't you come to the mic so we're sure to... We will have you on the recording.
I'm confused about... I see a staff draft, but then I also see a proposed ballot title. How are these... I mean, I can see how they're different. What purposes do the two of them serve?
Mr. Leventhal, what are you...
It's the last three pages of the handout...
I think there is something that looks like this that I think is the proponent's suggested title, I believe. Is that correct, Mr. Hoffmeister? And then the version that has the numbered lines is the staff draft.
So this is ours, and I didn't recognize it. Okay. So are we going to try and meld these together, or we have to pick one or the other?
My reaction was no movement.
Okay, which is just a little bit longer, but I think we can live with it because it is more descriptive. So, okay. Great. Okay.
And Mr. Leventhal, I overlooked the fact you are one of the proponents, so I just want to note that for the record. So it sounds like proponents are okay with starting at least with the staff draft. Is there anybody else present who wishes to comment on the staff draft? If not, then I'll turn to board discussion on the staff draft. Ms. Gomez has displayed the staff draft on the screen in the room. One of the requirements for the title board in setting titles is that we are required to clearly express the single subject of the measure, and the structure of the title typically does that first, after stating whether it's an amendment to the Constitution or to the statutes. The staff draft also recognizes that Tabor requires, in the case of tax increases, an estimate of that amount. That's why the staff draft has a blank for an estimate of the annual increase in taxes. I think maybe I'd first like to ask the board about the single subject expression. We'll come, but we at some point we do need to come to the tax increase question. And Mr. Hoffmeister, I'll give you a chance then to talk about the your view of the tax estimate. With respect to the expression of the single subject, just speaking for myself, I'd rather not say creating a voluntary system. To me, the expression of a single subject would be not an action, but just the subject itself. And I guess I would prefer just saying something like an amendment to the Colorado Constitution concerning a voluntary system of publicly financed campaigns for state elective officers. But I invite comment by the other board members.
I'd have no objection to that change.
Yeah, I'm fine with that.
Mr. Hoffmeister, do you have any objection to that change? Yes, so Ms. Gomez will show that change on the screen. It's changing the word creating to concerning. And Mr. Leventhal, if you want to be heard, do come to the mic also.
I think we may need to think about this just a little bit longer, because we really are creating something, aren't we, by creating a new article?
Well, in this part of the title, we're just trying to express the subject. What's the subject? What's the single subject of the measure?
Okay, fair enough.
I guess I'll go ahead and move then that change that substitutes the word concerning for the word creating.
Second.
All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
All those opposed, no. That motion carries 3-0. Shall we go ahead and turn to the fiscal estimate?
Something I wanted to bring up. The word voluntary is accurate in one sense, but it's ambiguous in another. It's voluntary for candidates. It's not voluntary for taxpayers, whether they want to contribute the way the federal system is for certain things. So I question whether that's misleading.
Maybe it would be better just to strike the word voluntary.
I think if we struck it there and then could explain it, make it clear in the rest of the measure what's voluntary and what's mandatory, I would prefer that.
Mm-hmm. Makes sense to me. Proponents? Please come to the mic.
The funny thing I find, or interesting thing I find in this, is language. And it's when you are developing something, you're not always attuned to the innuendos or the subtleties. And that's why I love this process.
Just wait till we get to the commas and the semicolons here in a little bit. You'll really enjoy that.
Then I'll move that change that we strike the word voluntary.
I'll second it.
Any further discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, no. That motion carries 3-0. Any further changes to the single subject portion? If not, then let's go back to line one, where the staff draft has a blank for the amount of the tax increase. And Mr. Hoffmeister, would you like to comment then on
yes,
as I said, we do have a fiscal analysis from Natalie Mullis, the chief economist, but. Go ahead and give us your view of that.
Just to give so that you have some background on this. When we started this effort several years ago, we were trying to figure out how much money we might need, and we did that by analyzing what competitive campaigns are costing in Colorado over the last several years. Then we tried to project what would happen if maybe a quarter of the people running for office the first year would try to run as publicly financed candidates, or a third. And just so you might know, in Connecticut, 75% of those running for office in 2008 ran as publicly financed candidates. That wasn't true in the other states, but was in Connecticut. At any rate, using this, we thought, well, what kind of assessment could we put on people's taxes that would be seen as reasonable and functional? And we've projected that if we could raise $10 to $12 million off taxes each year, it would provide the amount to get us started if we maybe had 25% or 30% of the candidates running that way. And then the surplus would be held over for the next two tax years. Finally, we got to the governor's race, the statewide offices, which are very expensive. They're running around $5 million just for the governor. And we asked the question, if we had two people running for governor, and both of them ran as a publicly financed candidate, that'd be at least $10 million. So we thought the way we could handle that is if we assessed each taxpayer $5 per year, it would cover that. And I'd looked at the number of taxpayers in Colorado. Several years ago, it's 2.5 million, it still is. So $5 times that was about $12 million, and that seemed like a reasonable amount to put to start with, without putting any excess burden on taxpayers. And then if we were projecting, what if this becomes real exciting, a lot of people run it, we do run for office as a publicly financed candidate, are we prepared to have the governor's race, all the statewide races, and the legislative races in the same year? And we thought we would have accumulated enough, or we could go with the maximum assessment of $10 per taxpayer to finance that. So we're comfortable with the boundaries. That's what Natalie has used in her tables. But there is a mistake, I think. And I'm not necessarily a good mathematician, but if you look at table, let's see, it's the second table, table two, if I can find it here, here it is. Actually, table one first. You'll notice that she says estimated number of total number of taxpayers for 2011. It's 2,545,196. So in my simplistic notion, take $5 times that. That would yield about $12.7 million. Then I looked at her table in table two, and she ends up with $17 million. And at first I didn't have time to call her, which I will do. But I thought, what in the world? How did she get $17 million when 5 times 2.5 million is 12.5 million? I realized what had happened is some confusion on joint filers. And while it's true that there are a million joint filers, that's only about, 550,000 returns, joint returns. And 10 times that added to the 6.5 million for the single filers would be about $12 million. So I think she just multiplied $10 times each of the joint filers, which is 10 times 1.15 million would be 11 million, when it should be about 5.5 or 6 million. So there was a confusion over what dollar amount to apply to what number of people in those tables. So our estimate, so to get beyond that, then the number we're proposing to put in the document is about $28 million. Because we thought we better, since this is going to the people, and they're going to see a dollar amount in this document, we'd better indicate a document that is high enough that it completely covers what we think the costs are going to be although we wouldn't raise that money initially, it would protect us down the line, so we don't have to go back to the people for another tax increase in order to protect, or in order to provide the dollar amount that's necessary to carry out this public financing effort. But the tricky part is Table 2, joint filers, and that $10 million that's in there on Table 2, surely we should be about five.
Maybe I didn't follow your explanation. I mean, the measure says that it's $10 on each joint state income tax return, and I thought she was saying that for 2011, there's 1.1 million of those.
Mm-hmm.
So that would be $11 million.
Well, the question is, what if you took that and you took 10 times those? Those folks are paying more per individual filer than those who are filing single returns, because they're only paying $5.
But it's two people filing a joint return, isn't
would be,
it?
That's right, but that means there's half as many filers, even though there are 1 million taxpayers, there's only half a million joint filers.
But I thought she was saying that there's the number of returns,
mm-hmm.
a number of joint returns is 1,152,000.
Well, that's what it looks like, but I couldn't find it this morning, but where I got my first figures here came from an earlier filing by the Department of Revenue. It was like two or three years ago, but I couldn't find it. It differentiated the way I'm proposing we should. That is, when you talk about joint filers, you should be talking about some 500,000 returns, two people per return.
So you think she's actually got the number of filers here instead of number of returns?
I think it's wrong. I mean, in one sense, it just increases the dollar amount we put in this blank, but I don't think that's a reason. I think it's significantly less than that. So that's why I'm challenging. I would like to talk to her just to make sure.
Yeah. I guess a couple of questions I'd like to ask about is that, you know, kind of relates to what year we're using. Tabor seems to say that we have to increase the amount, that we have to specify the amount of the tax increase. In the case of measures where it's phased in, we're supposed to estimate the first, the final full fiscal year dollar amount.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm trying to think that through. The measure says that the first year it's $5 and $10. It could be mm-hmm. more than that later if it's raised. The first question I have probably is, what is the first year? The effective date of the measure, Section 31, says this article takes effect January 1 in the second year
mm-hmm.
following passage. Well, passage, if assuming it occurs, would be November of this year. The first year following passage would be 2011. The second year following passage would be 2012.
That's a bad statement, too, because we were thinking about when we'd be ready to offer candidates public monies. The first year, we won't even have the money. That's not true. The income tax comes in on April 15th, and we'd have about, according to Natalie, 93% of whatever, all of that money would be available for the first year, the following November or the campaign period in July or so. So we'd have about $12 million for that first year, but we were assuming it would be safer to accumulate the money and then activate the whole process the second year.
Well, you may be getting a little ahead of me. I'm just wondering, when does the measure take effect? The effective date says it takes effect January 1 in the second year following passage. What January 1 are you referring to?
Well, I think we were talking about January 1. It'd be voted into office this year. It would the actual implementation of it would be 2 years later, is what we were thinking.
January 1, 2012. So the measure takes effect, the article takes effect January 1, 2012. So then the first time the tax would be collected then would be sometime after the measure takes effect, and I'm assuming then it would be tax returns filed that are due to be filed April 15th, 2012.
Well, to be honest with you, I'm a bit confused about this myself, because what we were trying to protect against is people running for office when we didn't have any money. And looking at Natalie's analysis helped me realize that, well, we would be getting taxes in 2011 that could apply to this. Those could be used at the end of that calendar year for people running for office. So maybe it should be changed the next fiscal year or something like that. I'm a little uncertain myself about the best way to do this, and I'm not an expert in finances, but we're trying to protect this so that we wouldn't put ourselves in a bind by not having the necessary money for the first time we implement it. But the way I would see it now, and would propose possibly modifying that, would be that the money coming in, the bill would be enacted this year if it passed, and that means the money would be, I have to back up, because I'm not, the W-2 forms or the tax statements are sent out well before they're going to be collected. We don't even know that this is going to be a bill accepted by the people until after the elections in November. So really, we'd have at least 1 year after that before we would even have any access to money to run these campaigns with. Now, how we say that, I agree, is a little tricky. But we originally had it 1 year after passage, and we thought, well, maybe we'd be more conservative, make it 2 years. But that's before I looked at Natalie's statements, and I think it would be more appropriate to say 1 year after passage, because then the money would be picked up in 2011, be picked up in 2012, actually, because it won't be on the tax forms in 2011. I mean, it was picked up in April. I don't see how the Department of Revenue could put that into tax forms that are already out and for the April collection. So it'd be the following year that we would actually begin collecting money.
So, I think I agree that as the measure is currently worded, and the wording says that it takes effect January 1 of the second year, I think I agree, it takes effect January 1, 2012.
Yes.
So the tax assessment would begin after January 1, presumably on returns filed after the measure takes effect. Those are mostly returns filed, are due to be filed April 15th. In 2012. Now, that first year, as returns are filed and they're subject to the $5 or $10 assessment, they're for the 2011 tax year, but the money starts to be collected, say, April of 2012. Mm-hmm. And that's for the state's fiscal year that ends June 30th. Mm-hmm. So the first fiscal year, the state's first fiscal year, is the measure is not fully in effect. Mm-hmm. So the collections for that first fiscal year that ends June 30th, 2012,
yes,
mm-hmm. is going to be, it's basically, well, I don't know. I guess that's the question. And then,
well, that's, I get confused still, but I like the way you're saying it, because then that following fall, that money would be available for people who wanted to run as publicly financed candidates if they could qualify. Because we collected in April, and that following July or August, whenever this process starts, that initial $12 million would be available for candidates if they qualified. But maybe the 2 years is a... Maybe we should leave it alone.
And as I understand the measure, it adjusts the, or it can be adjusted, the assessment can be adjusted based on how much this commission thinks is going to be required, which in odd-numbered years, there are few, if any, of these covered elections, right? Mm-hmm. So in odd-numbered years, or the year before an odd-numbered year, I guess, your assessment will be low, and then in even-numbered years, or the year before and leading up to an election year, it'll be at the high end, right? So the 2012 is likely to be a bigger number than if you waited to the next fiscal year or did the prior fiscal year. So I think that works out well to use the 2012 number to capture the high end of when this is actually going to be in effect and covering real elections or a real number of elections. So I think I think I'm in agreement that that's the right date to use. But I still, this is always, well, this is the part of Tabor that in this job I find most difficult is setting these numbers because I don't understand what happens the year after you put that number in there. So I'm always nervous about what we put in there.
Our intent was to make it possible for the commission to look at the amount of monies that had been raised relative to what needed to be spent, and we were seriously putting off the governors and statewide races till several years after, because we were afraid. If you looked at Maine, they have three people running for governor this year, and those are like $4 million races, and they're afraid they're going to bankrupt their campaign. So we were trying to be as conservative about this as we could. But where I'm headed with this is that, yes, following what you said, there would be about $25 million set aside that first year, and no governor's race would probably be involved. So we would use some of that money for the General Assembly races. Some of it would be left, so it's conceivable we wouldn't have to raise that much money the next year. So we would have 2 years before the next, actually 4 years before the next governor's race. So we're trying to give the commission the opportunity to make this assessment more reasonable. But at the same time, because of Tabor, we don't want to put too low an estimate in there. Because we know if we did that, we'd have to go back to the people for a further vote. So that's why we were thinking something like $28 million would be a safe, reasonable way to protect us from anything strange happening as we went down the line. The worst that could happen, wouldn't it be something if we had 50% of the people running for office who decided to run as publicly financed candidates? And suppose we reached the limit of the money set aside. I would think that would be marvelous myself. But then we put into this bill that the commission, seeing this, can then proportionally reduce the amount of money to any candidate and provide the opportunity for those candidates who are affected by this to go to the people for any way they wanted to raise the rest of the money up to the amount allocated. So we tried to anticipate this as best we could.
Mr. Cardin?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I wanted to follow up and make sure I understand the $28 million figure that you're putting out there. I think we're clear that this measure will be effective January 1, 2012.
Yes.
That it will impact tax returns filed after January 1, 2012. That the minimum for single filers is $5 and the maximum is 10. The minimum for joint filers is 10 and the maximum is 20. And aside from the issue of whether or not Natalie's
yes.
number for joint filers, if it,
yes.
that may be an issue. The $28 million that you're suggesting is the $10 for singles and a $20 for joint filers?
I mean, closer to 25. Yeah, I was suggesting for the blank about $28 million. I only think we would think of 25, but we're worried about an increase in population and therefore more tax filers, and therefore are we protected from demanding more money? Because suppose we had I don't think it'll happen, but even a 10% increase in population and tax filers would be 150,000 more people. 250,000 more people. And it that could ending up with a number beyond our original forecast of 25 million. So we were trying to put a little caution on this and put 28 million out there.
And let me just ask one more question, and I'm hopefully not to confuse things. So for example, on page 2 of the fiscal analysis on table 2, that's based on a $5, $10 joint filer, mm-hmm. the $17 million figure. And I think that's I think that may be the number that's one number that's under consideration for inserting in the blank in the measure. If you go to table 3, that's for fiscal year 2012-2013, and it looks as though what the economist has done there has done a minimum and a maximum range.
Yes.
So it would be 18.7 for the 5 and 10, and then it would be 36 for the 10 mm-hmm. and 20. Mm-hmm. So just again to come back, are you suggesting that the number that should be inserted in the blank reflect revenue from the maximum fee?
Yes. Okay. I am suggesting that because otherwise, because of Tabor, suppose we put in a lower number, and Tabor would require, if we're going to go beyond what the people have accepted, we've got to go back to the people for another vote. So that was kind of the rationale, and yet trying to find a number that really made sense.
Well, I appreciate your patience with my line of questioning here. Thank you.
Joel, did you have?
I just wanted to comment. On all the tables, of course, the joint filer number is the number of people, but not the number of returns. So any numbers that get carried forward on that confuse us more, assuming we understand what's there.
And then I guess I think there still may be an issue of whether or not, for example, on table 2, or rather on table 1, the 1,152,255 under joint filers is returns or people.
Exactly.
You think it's people?
I think it's people.
Okay.
Because that's the only way I could get from that number to 2 million, to look at the total line. To 2.5 million people, it's 1.392 plus 1.152. So that's actual people. But the second column, the joint filer, that's, although the total number of people who were filed there, it's actually joint returns, so the number of returns is about half that. And that we were using our language to say on joint returns, you're going to charge $10. Single return, $5. I understand it's confusing.
There were some other assumptions that Natalie Mullis made in her estimate, and I just wanted to just check with you about those. I think she excluded amended returns. I can't remember whether she included or excluded extended returns where there's extensions, but I just want to make sure you're comfortable with the assumptions that she made. There were some issues about that, mm-hmm. and I think there was also a question in her mind about you know, I think, let's see, were you limited just to individual returns, but excluding fiduciary, partnership, corporate, and so forth? I think that was another.
Those are all excluded, yes.
Yes. So you agree with her on all of those assumptions?
Everything is fine, except I was uncomfortable with how she got the 10 million in Table 2 from joint filers. I thought it should be closer to 5 million. Because that's taking $10 times all those people rather than $10 times the number of joint returns filed.
And Mr. Leventhal?
Yes, I'd just like to say, again, looking at the extended returns, so that's an additional $1.3 million of taxes, and we've actually added $3 million from 25 to 28, so we've actually added twice that much, just maybe fortuitously because we hadn't thought about this part of it. So I think we've taken that into account by using our 28 million number. We don't want to put ourselves out of business, so we're thinking we can do this with 12 million a year, but in terms of growth of the state, we said let's put in a factor of 2. So that gets us up roughly to 28.
Mr. Domenico?
There was one assumption in there that threw me off, and I guess I don't understand the lingo. But she says that single married joint and head of household returns are assumed to be single filer returns, and the married joint would seem to me to be a joint return, and that's where I was confused. And I'm so I just don't quite understand what that, whether that has any impact or if it's important, but that's what I thought joint returns were.
Yeah.
So. Well, what I would like to do, well, first of all, you can imagine how we would like to move ahead. We were set up, incidentally, this is a completely grassroots effort. There's no financial involvement of any magnitude at all in our effort. We're approaching this with the idea, if the people of Colorado don't really want to do this, we need to know that also. We think, however, from our discussions with people, there's a lot of dissatisfaction about what's going on, and this may be a good time to do it. But we're also concerned to have, like your comments this morning, and we went through the Legislative Council review, their comments were extremely helpful. And we would like to make sure this is correct. And so my intention is, incidentally, I've already been to Michael Hagiari with the proposed petition formats, and we're looking at that. We'd like to be able to go by the 1st of May. But I would also, for myself at least, like to have this issue of Natalie Mullis resolved. I don't know how that impacts what you folks do today. What I was hoping is if we came up with a $30 million blank to fill in there, that would be a reasonable amount.
$28 million.
That would be a reasonable amount. And if Natalie's estimate is higher, then we're hurting ourselves in the sense of limiting how much money we could actually collect. And otherwise, it would be $28 million, and therefore we could move ahead with efforts to get the petitions prepared.
Well, consistent with what you're saying, I think, you know, we can set a title with a number that we're comfortable with today. If you become uncomfortable with that number, perhaps after talking to Natalie Mullis or for other reasons, you could file a motion for rehearing within 7 days to request the title board to change that number. And either way, the Secretary of State's office won't formally approve the petition format until after the seven-day period is over anyway.
Yes.
So that you have those 7 days after today to decide whether you're happy with the titles. So.
Maybe I just say one more thing, and that is I was born in Fort Collins, so I've lived most of my life in Colorado. I have never been active in politics until the last 5 or so years. I find it I'd never want to run for office. But I find the process very interesting. As a Colorado citizen, I'm proud of it. I think what things you're doing here, but I have no idea what to expect, and you'll do what you think is best. But I'm impressed with the whole process. And thank you for the opportunity to participate in it.
Thank you. So your suggestion is just an even $28 million as to be inserted in the blank. And I'm comfortable with that at this point. Comment by the board.
Well, Domenico? As I said, this part of Tabor's election provision always makes me nervous because I don't quite feel comfortable that I understand what happens after the first year with that number. But my general understanding is that number continues to apply somehow, that it's not just a one-time limit. And so, given that understanding, I think I'm comfortable with the $28 million as a reasonable estimate and reasonable cap, in fact, not just an estimate, but a constitutional cap on what could be collected. Given that understanding, I'm comfortable putting that number in there and proceeding.
I don't know the format that we've used in the past. We could use $28 and then the word million, or put all numbers. I just don't remember. Is there a preference on the part of the board?
My vague recollection is using the $ and the word million, but I could be wrong about that.
Gomez is typing out that version. I'll move that change, striking the blank and substituting $28 million, the word million.
Second.
Further discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say no. That motion carries 3-0. Further discussion of the staff draft. Any other suggested changes to the staff draft?
The one concept that I was a bit wanted to make sure was clear, because it was important to me, I think, is that this is just an overlay on top of existing campaign system that people can opt in or opt out. If they opt out, they're still subject to all the other regulations we have, is my understanding. I think that's accurate. Maybe that was more important to me than it would be to a voter, because that was a question I had for single subject purposes. And I'm just not sure we need if that's clear enough or not, or if it's material, really. I just thought I'd bring that up for the board to consider.
In other words, since we struck the word voluntary in the single subject...
That makes it more important. I think it's the concept is in there, permitting candidates, but maybe we need to make it a little clearer.
Mr. Hoffmeister, any preferences or suggestions?
I was trying to find the section, but it clearly... I can't find it just off the cuff, but it clearly says participation in this process is voluntary. No one is required to do it. And I'm just trying to find the section where, but I know we have... That is such a critical thing. Let's see where it is. Let's see. Okay, it's under section 1, subsection 2. We therefore find and declare that providing a voluntary, citizen-funded election campaign system for all statewide and general assembly, primary, runoff and general elections will enhance democracy. So we are trying, I think we may have used it someplace else, but clearly the intent of this is it's a voluntary system as far as candidates participating in it.
Well, yeah, and I think it's pretty clear from the other language applies only to participating candidates, which is a defined term. And so I think it's pretty clear from how the thing works that's true. I'm not entirely sure it's clear from the staff draft that's how it works. So I don't know if we need to make any changes or not.
Mr. Carton.
How about in the 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7th line, a line that says, permitting candidates who seek public monies to run, who voluntarily seek public money, who volunteer to seek public money. Or voluntarily agree to seek public money, something like that. Because I understand your concern. And we had originally thought having it up front was a good place to put it, but your point was well taken. I thought it was, but maybe we could put that insert on line 7 or last line 6, or something like that.
Mr. Carton?
I guess maybe it would be prudent to go ahead and respond to that before I make my comment. Does that I guess I will, this Mr. Hoffmeister's suggestion,
that it's a ball. That suggestion would be to reword that, I think, so it would say permitting candidates who run for statewide elective office, General Assembly, State Board of Education, Board of Regents of the University of Colorado, to voluntarily become eligible, or voluntarily elect to become eligible, or something like that, to receive public funding, et cetera.
To voluntarily be after, between who and seek? Voluntarily run, to voluntarily.
It would be to, I don't know, to volunteer, after University of Colorado, I was thinking, to, and this is a split infinitive for now, but to voluntarily seek, I'm not sure what the right phrase is, but seek to receive or become, or just become, to voluntarily seek eligibility to receive public funds. I'm not quite sure the exact...
I think it fits there. Who voluntarily seek public monies. I mean, that's still not quite good. I agree. Incidentally, just as an aside, I already shared with you the notion that those of us who wrote this were common citizens. We spend hours sometimes debating three or four word phrase. It's been one of very interesting experience how you use language, but maybe this isn't the best place to put it in, but who volunteer, permitting candidates who voluntarily seek public monies to run for, seemed to me it would cover your concern, and mine too.
Mr. Carton?
I just wanted, my comment is, just kind of to back up.
Let me hear from Mr. Carton first.
I just want to make sure that I understand the basis for further clarifying. And I guess that the concern may be that the reader of the measure might interpret it as replacing the current system of contribution limits and accepting contributions from individuals and private money, basically, and that what we're trying to do is to put the reader on notice that this is in addition to, it's a voluntary system that is kind of a layer on the public campaign finance system. And I guess if there's a way to do that elegantly by inserting the word voluntarily in here somewhere, that I'd be supportive of that. But I guess what I'm saying is that I don't have that level of concern with the title as written. And I don't think it's critical that we highlight that this is a voluntary in addition to program. But I'm near ambivalent about that.
I think it's pretty important to make clear that not every campaign is going to have to be part of this. On the other hand, I agree there's a lot of permissive language in the title that I think makes that reasonably clear if you read the whole title. I might suggest it would be a little... might be a little clearer if you get rid of the words a system of publicly financed campaigns on line two, and then you're just creating, or you're doing something about publicly financed campaigns is the subject, but not necessarily creating a system, which to me suggests something kind of universal. Mm-hmm. And then I think you might be able to rewrite that clause that was being discussed before a little more easily if you delete a few words in there. And permitting candidates, and then delete everything up to for statewide elective office on line 6 and 7. So it'd be permitting candidates who run for statewide elective office, etc. And then you could inline 8 after the University of Colorado, say, to choose or to voluntarily or to opt into a system in which they receive public financing. I think that might be a little easier. Mm-hmm. So those are my 2 suggestions, I think.
I'd suggest let's try that. Ms. Gomez, if you will put that on the screen. So we would strike in line 2, system of. So we would just recreating A.
Yeah, I think A needs to go also.
I'm sorry, concerning publicly financed campaigns. Okay. Okay, so then down in line, end of line 6, leave that, permitting candidates who, and then strike seek public monies to, strike that. And Mr. Domenico, what would be the rest?
Well, I guess back where you were talking about in line 8, after University of Colorado, say something like to volunteer to become eligible or to choose to choose to receive public funding or to opt into a system in which they're eligible, if I can enunciate. Any of those, I think, would work.
And a nuance here for me, at least, this phrase that's in there now, become eligible, reflects the fact that someone may not succeed. I mean, they have to get the qualifying contributions and so forth.
Right, and they also have to abide by certain restrictions, which is important, I think. So it's not just you can say, I'd like some money. So then maybe the easiest way to do that is to choose or to volunteer. Or probably choose is better, actually. To choose to, right where the cursor is. I think.
To choose to become eligible to receive public funding?
Yeah, I would never want to try to diagram one of our titles, but there's a lot of prepositional phrases there, but I think that works.
And I guess, although I think something that may then be lost is that it looks like they can make that choice. They can choose to become eligible when in fact they can choose to seek eligibility, but if they don't get the contributions, they're not going to become eligible. So I'm not sure it's totally their choice. You know what I mean? So I wonder if for example, it would be better to say to seek to become eligible.
I think either one of the, that's probably better.
A lot of infinitives, but I'm okay with that. I think that's better. I do think that is an improvement. Then I'll go ahead and make that motion that we make those changes as shown on the screen.
Second.
Any further discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed, no. That motion carries 3-0. Any further changes to the staff draft? If not, is there a motion to adopt the staff draft as amended?
So
moved. I'll second that. For the record, I'm going to read the first part. We did not make any changes past line
8.
So I'm going to read the first portion where we did have changes, but I won't read the full thing. So as amended, the title would read: state taxes shall be increased $28 million annually by an amendment to the Colorado Constitution concerning publicly financed campaigns for state elective offices, and in connection therewith, creating a Colorado Citizens-funded campaign fund to be funded by an annual assessment on each individual state income tax return of no less than $5 and no more than $10, and an annual assessment on each joint state tax return of no less than $10 and no more than $20, semicolon, permitting candidates who run for statewide elective office, comma, the General Assembly, comma, the State Board of Education, comma, and the State Board, and the State Board, and excuse me, and the Board of Regents of the University of Colorado, to seek to become eligible to receive public funding for their primary or general election campaigns by raising a specified amount of seed money contributions and qualifying contributions, semicolon. And the rest of it would remain the same as it appeared in the staff draft. And the understanding is these same changes would be made in the ballot title and submission clause, which follows this. It's simply the same, but it's in the form of a question. That's the motion before the board. Any further discussion? If not, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, no. That motion carries 3-0, and that completes action on number 53. The time is 10:35 a.m. Thank you.
Nice word.
Yes, sir.
I hate to be too complimentary. I mean, it maybe is ill-served, but it is a delight to see you folks at work helping us move ahead with something we think is very important. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
Do we need a break, or are we?
We do.
Okay, so we'll take about a 5-minute break.